KPI.
Thank you for joining Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. I want to remind you that if you would like to have a comment or chat with us or suggest somebody to be on in the future or ask a question, you can do that by submitting it to disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. That's Disability and Progress, all written out, at samjasmine.com. Okay, Charlene Dahl is my research woman and PR woman. Hello, Charlene.
Good evening, everyone.
Thank you for joining us on this July 25th, 2024 episode. Oh, I engineer too. That's right. Okay, Aaron's my podcaster. Hello, Aaron. This week, I want to first start out by thanking Joanne Lipsink. Lipink. Joanne was responsible for gathering and coordinating all the people to come here. She is also the coordinator of Minnesota Metro Regional Quality Council, which is MRQC, which is probably a much quicker way to say that. So thank you for coordinating this, Joanne, and helping me out with all the topics that should be discussed. Tonight, we are speaking with Sophie Iverson. Sophie is a Metro Regional Quality Council Associate, and she will be with us. We also have Carly Hargath. Sorry. Carly is the ARC Minnesota Advocate Associate and Self-Advocate as well. And we also have Heidi. Heidi is the Department of Human Resources Representative. And last but certainly not least, we have Dr. Frank Cadwell. Hello, Frank.
Hello. Thanks for having us today.
Yes. Where are you? There you are. Frank is a college professor where he was informing me that he does computer programming. He's also a parent advocate. And so we're speaking tonight about disability and housing and how affordable and it is and how affordability and how it all works. So thank you for joining, everyone. Do we have everyone figured out now?
Yes, it looks right.
Okay. Can you hear me, Carly? And I still don't hear them.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay.
We've got thumbs up and checks.
All right. So just make sure you work your mics close, please, so you come out nice and clear. Thanks so much for starting. And let's start with Sophie. Hi, Sophie.
Hi there.
Thank you for joining us. Can you start out by giving us a brief summary of an explanation about, you know, the MRQC? And I guess I kind of introduced the presenters, but give us a little bit of idea about what the MRQC is and what they do. And also, how did you get involved?
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for having me. My name is Sophie, and I am the Metro Regional Quality Council Associate. Mm-hmm. And the ARC Minnesota's Metro Regional Council is part of the Regional Quality Council and is made up of various community members, advocates, state and county representatives, and providers within the metro area whose goal is to improve the quality of life for people with disabilities. And the Metro Regional Quality Council specifically serves Dakota, Hennepin, and Scott County. And it also promotes all communities of people with disabilities so that services and supports can help them live a life based on their hopes and dreams. The council works together with our members to continually monitor and improve the quality of services. And it also seeks to improve person-centered outcomes, quality of life indicators, and drive overall systems change. The council meets once a month and has various work groups that are in areas of transportation, housing, and employment. As you probably mentioned, this time we're going to be focusing more on the housing work group that our council has and the project that we've been working on. And to join the council, you can go to, it is qualitycouncilmn.org, and you can find the Metro and the information there.
And how did you discover the MRQC?
Yeah, so I discovered the MRQC because I actually had been an intern at the ARC back in 2021, mm-hmm. Through a different department, and then I was notified of the RQC through my internship. And I've always been an advocate for people with disabilities. I have a disability myself. Uh-huh. And so being involved in that is my passion. And through that, I was first joining as an RQC member and then now serve as the associate alongside Joanne, the coordinator.
Excellent. Carly, you have a housing journey story. Can you share a little bit about your housing journey and some of the barriers that you have faced?
Sure. I had moved out on my own in September of 2009. Mm-hmm. I also have a disability. I have a rare metabolic disorder and also epilepsy. But I moved out on my own in 2009 and actually got in contact with the ARC of Minnesota's Housing Access Services Program. Mm-hmm. And so my sister was in college and my brother was off getting ready to go to college. And I did try online courses. However, it wasn't the right fit for me. So I was like, well, college life wasn't, but it's like I needed to break away from my parents' house. So I ended up finding a small apartment in town, and I was 5 minutes away from my parents and stuff. However, a major barrier was transportation for me. So I was relying on neighbors and friends and family to take me to different places, and I really didn't have much of a social life. So I ended up moving then to Winona, Minnesota. I currently lived in Eitzen, Minnesota. But I moved to Winona, Minnesota then in 2019. And so now I do have transportation. It's still kind of an issue, but it's better. I am able to use the city transit currently now. So that's been a plus barrier-wise there. And mm-hmm. I'm having more of a social life. I guess before my social life depended on my going out to dinner with my parents because I was so limited to transportation that way.
Yes.
So.
Well, that's amazing thing about small towns, right? You know everyone. They are often very lovely about helping you out, but it's still not quite independent when you have to.
No.
You know, and they're probably excellent and very willing to help, but it's not the same that you always have this, well, are they going to feel okay about taking me wherever? And is it convenient for them? There's none of this, I want to go where I want, when I want. And I don't want to have to feel beholden to anyone. So who were some of your supporters as along the way?
My parents were really supportive, and my grandma was also in town and mm-hmm. gave me the encouragement to move on my move out on my own, because it was a little scary. I mean,
sure,
you live with your parents most of your life, and then this is like, well, now, oh, I'm on my own. But the ARCS Housing Access Services program also did help find programs like an energy assistance program to help save money in that source, and also getting me on Section 8. So, I mean, those did help financially wise. So otherwise, like, now it's like I am also signed up with the Cardinal of Minnesota, who helps with grocery shopping and errands also. So that's mm-hmm. another support system that way that I have. And I also was able to get on Social Security too, but I have more connections now in Winona with friendships now, and I'm just relying on City Transit, still help from like friends every now and then if it's longer distances, but I feel more and more, and I guess more independent now that I'm not relying on family members anymore.
Right. Heidi, your representative, did you want to add anything to Carly's story?
Sure. Hi, I'm Heidi Hamilton from Department of Human Services, and it's really great to hear Carly's story about how she was able to decide what was important to her and really make decisions based on that. We at the department provide different services and supports to help people like Carly find different housing options and help them figure out what kind of supports they're going to need to live in their home in the community. Mm-hmm. The point Carly made about transportation is a huge deal for people.
Absolutely.
On where people decide to live.
So what are some options that for Carly's situation, like obviously she has, I'm guessing that some of her transportation is like a bus when it decides to run, but like, I don't even know. I understand like in the Twin Cities, we have Metro Mobility. I don't know if they have that there. And now I feel like more and more of the cabs that used to have these special kind of programs, they're losing it to Uber or Lyft. Does she have any other options besides busing or people who live in that part of that area?
Sure. Well, we have different areas of the state have tried to get creative on how they're looking at transportation options. Mm-hmm. And I know there are some areas that are looking at using home and community-based waiver funding to pay for Uber and Lyft, which has been interesting to figure out how that works with public funding. So I think people are just being creative and trying to figure out solutions for transportation.
I'm wondering if you would talk a little bit, or one of you would talk a little bit, maybe you, Heidi, about, you know, informing listeners about the current DHS requirements for housing, and maybe an overview of different types of housing programs.
Sure. There is a huge affordable housing crisis in Minnesota.
Yeah.
It's even a bigger problem when you talk about accessible affordable housing.
Right.
So it's a big challenge finding places to live, and we need to talk about two aspects. We need to talk about how people pay for their housing, mm-hmm. and what services and resources are available for that. And then also what services are available to help people live in the community.
Let's start with paying for housing, because that's a big deal.
Sure.
You can't pay for what you can't afford to live in.
that's right. We have a resource in Minnesota called Housing Benefits 101, which is a website. The address is mn.hb101.org. And it's a free website that helps people learn about the different options for paying for housing. It's very complicated, and there's different options depending on what your individual situation is. And so this website covers a lot of that information and provides plain language articles and brochures and simple visuals to help explain to people the process you can go through to figure out how to help pay for your housing. And I encourage people to take a look at that and see what benefits they may qualify for in their individual situation. There's options including income supplements for people who have low income. There's project-based housing where an entire building is subsidized by the state or federal government. And then there are voucher programs where a person can take a voucher to a unit where the landlord accepts it. So there's a lot of different options available, and I really encourage people to take a look at that website and see if they can find out some more information that's helpful for them.
So I wonder, Heidi, if you could, you know, I think when I first moved to Minnesota, there was a voucher program that I used. And like, is there a brief way you can kind of go through like what the brief qualifications are for each one of those for landlords or for people? Like, can anybody with a disability use any of those, and it's just a matter of where they can get in, or how does that work?
It's a little challenging to go through the programs in that way because there's so many different programs, and each has a little different criteria for accessing it. But generally, when we talk about the voucher programs, it's available for anybody who meets the criteria. And a lot of times it can be either a low income voucher or a voucher specific for people with disabilities. And it's available anywhere where a landlord accepts it. Now, there are some landlords who don't accept voucher programs, and so you would need to have a conversation with the landlord and figure out if it's something that they'd be willing to accept. In the environment we're in right now, where it tends to be a landlord environment, you know, really supportive of landlords, it's a little more difficult to get a landlord to take a voucher when they have five other people asking to rent an apartment.
And they can pay full rent, yeah.
Right. So it really is a lot of building up relationships and working with the supports that we have to help people find housing, and helping develop those relationships and talk about how you'd be a good tenant in that mm-hmm. building mm-hmm. and figuring that out with the landlord.
And do these programs offer the landlords any incentives to be willing to do them?
Not typically. It's typically that the landlord doesn't need to accept a lower rent amount. They're accepting a full rent amount. It's just paid through public funds.
Gotcha. So one of the things that I have heard sometimes is like, if somebody does find accessible housing or affordable housing even, that it's just not in, I think it's a little different in the small towns, you know, if they can find it, but in the Twin Cities especially, that it's maybe not in as good a place area. And so I wonder if you could speak to that and what is being done with that, if anything.
Yeah, I think that's a big challenge. We do have services that can help people figure out what's the most important thing for them when they're looking for housing. Mm-hmm. So if it is location, if it's the type of housing that they're looking for, if it's, you know, like we talked about earlier, on a bus line. So we have supports that can help people figure out how to make choices on what's going to be the most important for them. But I know that the issue that you're mentioning about the location of affordable housing is definitely a concern that I think everybody needs to be aware of and continue to talk about.
Can you talk about a little bit about, you know, the whole idea of a group home versus living independently in an apartment living? And kind of talk a little bit about that, the services that where there are similarities or differences and things like that?
Sure. We have a variety of services that are available in Minnesota through our Medicaid or Medical Assistance Program. And we have services that are available to help people living in their own home or a family home that provides as-needed assistance, helps people learn different skills, helps people figure out their transportation, figure out how to pay their bills, and provide assistance as the person needs it. Then we also have services that are available in multifamily housing units and apartment buildings, but that the units are controlled by a provider. So the services in those settings are licensed, but the setting itself is not licensed. And that's a nice in-between kind of place for some people who may not be quite ready to live in their own home, but are not also wanting to live in a more congregate setting. And then we do have services in a licensed residential setting where both the services and the setting are licensed. And these are community residential settings, which provide 24-hour care to an individual, or assisted living settings where the provider's on site but may not be directly with the person 24 hours a day. So we have a range of services available, really depending on what a person's level of needs are, what their preferences are for the type of services that they're receiving. A lot of times it might depend on what other natural supports they have in place and housing costs, like we discussed as well, that factors into that decision. But no matter where a person lives, if they're receiving Medicaid services, certain federal rules apply that require that people have enough information to make an informed choice about where they're choosing to live and the types of services that they're choosing to receive, that they're treated with respect and in a person-centered way so that they can make their own decisions about how and when and where they get their services, and that they have the opportunity to be involved in the community to the extent that they want to be.
All right. Well, I guess Dr. Frank... It's your turn. So you have a housing story. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, what it's like being a parent, you know, of a person with a disability and also group home living and things like that?
Sure. First of all, it's really good to hear
from Heidi. I'm actually learning a lot about what's out there. And I think that that's the main story that we have as parents. Our son isn't ready to move out yet necessarily of his family home, but it's a situation where it's hard to understand as a parent all of what's out there. And so, for example, in his case, and it really is about, or in my opinion, it's about, you know, our kids or the people living their best life, whatever mm-hmm. that best mm-hmm. life happens to be.
Right.
And in his case, he really likes hanging out with, you know, people that he can relate to and things like that. And so sometimes we think, you know, a group home would be a good setting for him just because, you know, it'd be, now his guitar might be a different situation, obviously, but, you know, depending on that situation. But it's you know, it's good to know, or you know, he enjoys, you know, that type of setting. And generally speaking, the state has been, or they appear to have been, you know, closing a lot of group homes and a lot of changes there because there's been such a movement to independent living. And then also as parents, it's really overwhelming to try to understand all of the different things that are out there. And everything is so disparate. So, you know, you have the housing fund and the healthcare fund and the this fund and the that fund. And there just isn't, you know, it's not like you can, you know, spend money in different ways. And are you going to be on a waiver program or are you going to use licensed services and all those things? And then in his case in particular, You know, while he can do a lot of things, you know, he's pretty easy, or easy isn't the right word, but he's pretty agreeable to a lot of things, but he needs somebody there because he has epilepsy and mm-hmm. he might have a seizure or all these right. different things that, you know, sometimes even it takes convincing of the caseworker or something, because it's like, you know, he can't be, you know, left alone. Like, you know, that's why we do, for example, Metro Mobility and things right. like that, because it's not like he can just kind of get on a bus and you know, he's a very trusting individual. You know, he's the type of person that will take the candy from the guy in the van. So he needs to, you know, you know, he
kind of vulnerable a little.
Yeah. You know, his safety needs to be observed and watched out for, and those sorts of things, because, you know, he'll you know, which is, it's a nice quality, you know, in a right. large way, because it's really
easy for you guys.
Easy for us, and he's very enjoyable to be around, and people really like him and all those sorts of things. But, you know, unfortunately it can be a big, bad world out there.
Right.
So, I think, you know, with staffing the way it is, and then, you know, sometimes as a parent, you kind of feel like you're in this desert of, you know, where do we go? Because you all of a sudden you're responsible for finding staff. You're responsible for finding roommates. And oftentimes my understanding is there's kind of limits on how many, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Heidi, you know better than I do, but, you know, limits as far as how many people with special needs can be under one roof, and kind of all of those sorts of things that need to be worked out. And so those things can get really hard, because all of a sudden you can't necessarily share all of these things across different people. And then in his case, he needs staff. He needs someone there to make sure he's getting his meds, to make sure all mm-hmm. these other things are happening. You know, not that he needs somebody, you know, over him and following him right. around necessarily, but just making sure that those things are taken care of.
A little bit of a check once in a while.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's just hard as parents. There's just so many different things, and it can just kind of blow you away. And then just to kind of, you know, another person's story within MRQC, you know, everybody has different needs, right? Like there's
right.
another person who's a parent advocate, and she really can't have a multi-dwelling for her son, because he really needs a yard, because he needs areas, you know, to run around in and things like that. Whereas, you know, my son is the opposite of that. If he kind of has his little area, he's, you know, he's usually good to go. But yeah, so those are the things I think that from a parent perspective, all of these just different things that you have to do or figure out just gets to be really overwhelming.
So there's a couple things I hear here. And so Carly or Heidi, whoever would be best to jump in and address this. So one of them, I feel like it's the parent of a person with a disability who wants just the best for their son or daughter is overwhelmed totally with knowing what choices and what might be the pros and cons, and what, you know, they might, you know, how much do they have to be responsible for the overall things. Can you speak to that a little bit first?
This is Heidi.
Okay.
It is overwhelming, and I admit that the system that has been created over the past 40 years is very complicated, and I understand how challenging it is for families, for people with disabilities, to figure out how to navigate that system. We do have a resource, the Disability Hub, which is a people that you can call and ask questions to help you navigate the system and help explain things to you. Excuse me. So we've made that available to people to try to help alleviate some of the challenge. But and we also are always trying to look for ways to simplify our system. We have a project right now we're working on called Waiver Reimagine, which is attempting to streamline the waivers to make them easier to understand for people to navigate and provide more opportunities for people to direct their own services if that's the choice that people make. But I really appreciate hearing about the personal experience that you're having navigating the system.
And is there a, you know, it sounds like, and I've heard a little bit of this, that group homes have closed, that there's the staffing shortages. I have had some on my show, and I know they're the ones that are working are really working hard to give incentives to staff and make a pleasant environment for staff. But there comes a point where you're doing what you can do. And so is there a lack of group homes? Is the system just not robust enough to handle that as staff wise? What does this look like now?
Yeah, our data is still showing that there's a lot of group homes available across the state, and I don't know if they're available in the place where people want them to be, but we are definitely experiencing a workforce shortage crisis in the state and across the country. The legislature has made some really significant investments over the past couple of years to increase staff wages, but it's not enough. There's just not enough people to really provide the services. And so we're having to figure out ways to be creative and support people using assistive technology and other things that can really make the staff that we do have go further in supporting people.
But it sounds kind of like the staff that you do have, then they have almost an extra burden, so to speak, put on them, because they have to work kind of twice as hard because they're not fully staffed, or maybe they're, you know, because of the shortage.
Absolutely.
So I wonder what it feels like. It's changed compared, let's say, 10 years ago or 12 years ago. I think there always needed to be a higher pay, and that part I think they've done some of that, but I don't know that it, like you said, it may not be enough. But I don't know what else. It feels like there's more that's changed, that there's such a shortage. So, and I don't know if you have the answer to that, but it's just my observation, I guess.
Yeah, I wish I had the answer to that. I know we've done quite a few studies on what's happening. Part of the issue is also the aging population of our state. And we have more people who are older and living longer who also need staff to support them. And just the number of staff we have available are not keeping up with the growth of the population of people needing supports.
We were talking about, you know, housing, and is there any, how I hear Heidi and whoever else wants to chime in, is that, you know, it's hard enough for, I don't think I like the term able-bodied people, but, you know, that just, quote, people who don't need the services that people with disabilities do to find housing that they can afford or be in. So I can't imagine what it is for people with disabilities now. Are they making any attempt to try to remedy this? And do you know anything about what they're doing? Nobody?
I can answer from this state perspective.
Okay, so yes.
We are making services available to people that will help them specifically with their housing search, especially because it's so challenging now to find a place that, because you're competing with all of the other people out there. We have a new Medicaid benefit called Housing Stabilization Services, which is available to people who are on medical assistance. They don't need to be on a waiver or need any additional supports in that way, but it's really to help people find housing and figure out how they're going to pay for housing and all of the things that go along with that, and help them develop relationships, negotiate with the landlord. We were actually the first state in the country to offer a benefit like this through our Medicaid state plan program, and now other states have followed suit.
Heidi, you're a little far from your mic, so if you could be right.
Sorry. So 18,000 people accessed that service in 2023, and mm-hmm. we are continuing to see growth because it's a huge, huge need to even just have that additional support to help people find that housing.
I wonder, there's this mentality of kind of not in my backyard. And is this, do you think how do we educate, you know, the general person that, you know, group homes are fine, and that it's a lot of times you get renters that are there for a long time, or people that are there for a long time and it's stable, and, you know, what can be done, do you think, to educate the general public to be okay with, you know, people with disabilities living kind of around them and in their area? And I mean, I make it sound maybe a little worse than it is, but there are sometimes this attitude. So maybe you could speak to that.
Sure. I think it's more exposure and more people meeting individual people with disabilities who work at their grocery store or just are part of their community, and see that they are members of the community. Years ago, Minnesota had state institutions where people with disabilities were housed and were put separate from the rest of the community. Mm-hmm. But now people are living in all neighborhoods, and are everywhere you go are people with disabilities. And so I think it's just a matter of continuing to develop those relationships and for people to see that people with disabilities are just like everybody else and are enjoying their lives in their communities just like everybody else is.
Sophie, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how benefits and earned money affect housing.
Yeah, so in regards to if someone is searching for housing or looking to maintain housing, I mean, all of us know that in order to get housing, most of the time you need to have some sort of income or ability to pay for housing. And sometimes it can become a challenge because many people with disabilities or in the community might receive benefits like Social Security or other forms of payment. We've talked about other housing programs that offer Section 8 vouchers or subsidized housing. And this can often contradict with the other parts of someone's life, namely paying for housing or even having access to services. Because in the state of Minnesota, there is some programs that have income limits. Mm-hmm. There are some programs that require someone to be under 200% of the federal poverty guideline. And there is some requirement in services or programs like medical assistance. There are different types of medical assistance in the state of Minnesota, and each of those might have an income limit. And so someone who is receiving Social Security benefits or SSDI or SSI might have not necessarily a barrier to receiving those services, but just a little bit more of need, a little bit more of an awareness of what programs and how the different programs interact with each other. And one place that you can definitely talk about that, if that is your situation, is calling the Disability Hub. They're a great resource. They have people and staff who are trained in walking through those different programs with you. In addition, the ARC Minnesota also has a help desk that has staff who are versed in those different programs or at least have the resources to share that. And so definitely reach out to them if that is something that you're concerned about. And I think Heidi or Carly can also talk more into how Social Security and other programs may be impacted by your income. But I think that's the basis that I would want someone to be aware of.
You know, I don't know. I think I do see that as a barrier. Just hearing it is like, why is this such a deal that you have to be so poor to be able to be given, you know, a lower income to be able to live somewhere? I don't think I understand that concept of keeping somebody. It's like it's that old thing that they say, keeping you in your place type thing. So Carly, I wonder if Carly or Heidi or one of you wants to kind of address this.
Sure, yeah, I can speak a little bit of like my experience. I am currently on RSDI, but I was on SSI, and it's like with that my income could only be under like $2,000. So that would like, that's the checking, the savings, and like any other assets, it can only remain under $2,000 your bank account could. You always had to make sure that it's like you, because if you went over like the 2000 mark, you'd get your Social Security taken away or you'd have to reapply. And I mean, I think even trouble now for people with disabilities, if they want to get married or move on like that.
That's probably a whole other show.
A whole other thing in general. But I mean, it's also getting cut because like you're adding another person to the household. So I mean, if you're moving out as a couple, that's another way too to like, that you really have to think about. It's like, well, how are we going to correspond this? It's like if we're depending just on one person's income.
So to me, in a nutshell, it's okay, so stay poor. Don't develop a relationship. Don't. I mean, there's so many things. I feel like I'm not sure if there's anything that is happening in the, I mean, I know the legislator stuff is kind of done now, but I would hope that somebody starts addressing this more, because everyone knows that stable relationships, stable people who live in a long-term housing situations create a whole bunch of good things environmentally, including, you know, safer neighborhoods and you know who's living by you and just so many other things. So I don't know if anyone wants to kind of speak to the whole poverty thing. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to speak from our experience as well, my son works at a thrift store once a week, and he does get paid a very small amount of money for that. And he, and every so often, my wife usually takes care of it, so I'm not exactly sure how often we get these things, but maybe quarterly or something, we get these adjustments from Social Security. It says, oh, you know, for the next 3 months, $8 or something is going to be taken out of his Social Security check. Literally that amount, or $8 or $20. And there's two questions about that. One is, how much is it costing the federal government to have them sit there and actually figure that all out?
Amazing, right?
Yeah, number one. And then number two is, it gets to your point about trying to, you know, that it's basically staying poor, that putting a person in their place. And that's the thing about that. So that income is, and that's where I get into the disparate things, because, you know, you have the money for health care, then you have a different fund for housing, then you have a different fund for this and a different fund for that.
God forbid if you get sick.
Yeah, exactly. God forbid if you get sick. But also, you know, there's been, you know, and I know this would be a whole nother show, so I don't go too deep into this, but there's, you know, minimum income has been experimented with, and there's been a lot of success around that because people know what they need, and they're not going to go out and spend money on stuff that they don't need. And so it's been highly successful to allow people the freedom to decide how they need to spend their money. They're going to go first find housing and food. That's what they're going to do. They're not going to go out and, you know, party or something.
And so maybe the ones that don't control, I'll go a little step further, the ones that maybe just don't have the ability to control the choices of how they're spending the money, maybe that person that would have been writing to you and deducting the $20, you'd get somebody who would check in with them. Let's see, I see you have this much, so let's lay out a thought plan of what you're spending that on this month.
Exactly.
And so it is interesting because I don't want you to quote numbers necessarily, but I'm guessing for Social Security, I would guess your son doesn't make more than $900 a month.
And that's you're pretty much almost right on the money there.
And so, and then for the once a week, you know, I'm guessing what, $50?
If that, usually.
So if you 40. Do that, you know, you're $200 more. So that's $1,100. It's not even a living wage.
Right.
So this is, I don't know if any of you have answers, but this is something that I feel like this is probably one of the deep, deep things that needs to be addressed. And even more than, I mean, housing is important. I don't want to say it's not, but just, if you don't even have the income to live in the housing and pay your bill and buy food and pay for transit and buy yourself clothes when you need to, then there's a problem.
Well, and in his situation, getting back to what we were talking about before with staffing, in his situation, he... If we're not around, he needs more space than just one person because he needs staff to help him.
Right.
They need a place to sleep if they're going to be there at night or whatever. So you and the thing with staff, and I apologize, Heidi, if you said this, I can't always hear really well in these headphones, but the thing about, I think, with staffing is that there needs to be a career path for a lot of people want to do this work, but they can't make it a career. So then they go off, they use it for something where they're, you know, it's a college job or something.
Right.
Or they get to be 25, 26 and they go off and do other things.
They want to start a family.
Yeah.
They want to, yes.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people that want to keep doing it. And so there should be a career path for this, because whether it's my son or whether it's people that are middle-aged with disabilities or even seniors, you know.
Which there will be a whole lot more.
Exactly.
Coming up pretty soon.
So you have seniors out there that need help and need things and need staff in order to help care for them, and they don't, you know, they don't necessarily need a nursing home, so it'll be a lot cheaper to have somebody come in a few times a week. But if there's no money for that, then it winds up being this sort of situation where then they have to go to a nursing home, and then we as a society wind up, overspending for that. And so it just winds up being kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy kind of thing. So I think, you know, as hopefully, and I know that the state is trying to do things to make it more of a career, and I hope that that continues to be something that's explored, that, you know, you have experienced people that are doing this, because then they can help the parents too. Because again, we as parents, it's hard to, you know, go about our own lives and then, you know, try to be figuring all this other stuff out that,
Carly, Heidi, or Sophie, do any one of you want to respond to this? Or
I think I can, this is Sophie. I can just quick respond. I just want to note, and I think Frank kind of said it, is that the, you know, issue, so to say, with Social Security disability or Social Security in general, it's a federal issue. It's not a state issue. And as much as us as Minnesotans and people who utilize state Medicaid programs, it's constantly competing with the federal government of the who controls Social Security and how those rules are operated. And so when we look at, oh, what do we do about it? Well, what we do about it is contact your state senator, contact your federal state representative, and talk to them, share a story, just like Carly and Frank are sharing on here, and continue to bring awareness and educate what is going on in the state at a federal level, because hopefully through that means we can push the dial a little bit more towards creating a more equitable situation for people who are on Social Security and utilize these supports and services.
Absolutely. We need to wrap things up. Is there anything more anybody would like to add?
Well, I would just like to thank you for having us here today. It's been nice to get to know you, and this has been a new world for me, so thank you.
Well, I wish you the best of luck for finding a place for your son to jam out, and some musical buddies that he would feel good sharing with. And I think we have a long road to go, but I'm hoping that some brilliant soul out there who is very loud and musical with their wheels will start turning them and make some changes. Sophie or Heidi, anybody else need anything more to add?
I'll just mention the couple websites that
yes, I please do.
So there's the Disability Hub, which is a great resource for any question related to disability services. And the website there is disabilityhubmn.org. And then the other website is HB101, which provides information about housing benefits in Minnesota, and that's mn.hb101.org.
Thank you so much.
Oh, and I will quickly mention again the Regional Quality Council. If you want to join or get more information about that, you can find it at qualitycouncilmn.org.
Thank you, everybody. I really appreciate you being on, and just want to, thank Joanne LePink one more time for all helping, kind of corralling everyone, and also for helping me with the topics here. Thanks. Thank you, everyone, so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. This has been Disability in Progress. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research PR person, and Aaron is my podcaster. Thank you, everybody, from MRQC. We have Sophie Iverson, Carly Hargath, and Hamilton, I think, and Dr. Frank Codwell. This is KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, and KFAI.org. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. Thanks again for joining me. You can reach me at disabilityinprogress@samjasmine.com. Thanks for listening. KFAI.